This is the ongoing story of a loving wife and mother of three, who seemingly vanished into thin air on New Year's Day. A wife who stood by her husband through good and bad, and a wife who would eventually become victim to the evil within that relationship. This is the story of Anna Walsh and the ongoing search for justice. This is Finding Anna.
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates and conversations on the case as we have them. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod. Today, we're going to be talking with one of the nation's foremost legal analysts, Anne Bremner, going to be joining us to discuss what is going on here with the case of Brian Walsh, where this is going to be going, and specifically the past criminal history of Brian Walsh. How much is that going to play a factor in the new criminal prosecution of Brian Walsh? He was already on house arrest wearing an ankle bracelet, which he even violated that when he went on his Home Depot shopping spree. But how much of his history tells us about who he is today and puts the pieces of the puzzle together as to what he became and the ability for him to carry out the crimes allegedly that he did. But first, before we get to that, let's review. Let's go back in time. Let's take a look at some of the crimes that this man committed. And while we're doing that, think very carefully about empathy. This has been an ongoing thing, an ongoing theme with this case, with, well, most killer cases, the Koberger, Idaho murders case. But the not ability, but inability to feel emotion for others and then essentially realign your ship so you don't do horrible things to other people. And obviously, he should know murder is bad. But he should have known a lot of things, it turns out, in his life that were bad and didn't really seem to do it. Treated it with the same sort of disregard as going out and ordering a value meal. As compared to selling fake Warhols online or killing his wife, allegedly. So let's go back here before we start talking with Anne about all of this. We're going to go back to 2016. Walsh entered a guilty plea in 2021 for this crime. It was for wire fraud and selling two phony Andy Warhol artworks back in 16, which it wasn't like he just found these or got these or curated these from someone and then tried to sell them. No, he stole them first. He stole them from a friend in South Korea. The paintings purchased back in 2016 by his friend, according to the court documents, and then stolen by Brian Walsh, ended up in his possession. And he promised his friend when his friend, you know, realized his Warhols had been stolen. He said, you know, I got you. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sell these and I'm going to make you a bunch of money rather than returning the stolen property. I'm going to do this. However, when he returned to the States from visiting South Korea and stealing the Warhols, he stopped responding to his friend's messages, ghosted him, if you will. When Walsh went to South Korea in 2012 to attend a friend's wedding, that was the last time he saw his friend. After that, Walsh sold one of the paintings to Ron Rivlin, who's the owner of the Revolver Gallery in California. That is the largest Andy Warhol gallery in the world. If you like Warhols, that's the place to go and check it out. Sold on eBay for a price of $80,000. And it wasn't just a listing where the gallery found it and put in a bid. There was conversation. There was context to the purchase prior to it actually happening. According to the actual ad on eBay, and the materials that were filed in the case, Walsh made it appear in the advertisement to sell the artwork that he had overpaid for it. And he was just, you know, trying to get some of his money back. It said, quote, "We overpaid terribly in 2007 for the art. Price paid $240,000. We're trying to sell on eBay because it's much cheaper. Because Christie's won't be able to auction our pieces until May of 2017. You know, you're going to get a good deal here right now because we are just not going to wait till May of 2017 to sell these. So, you know, come first serve. You're going to love this, that sort of thing. According to the lawsuit filed in court, Walsh stated that Rivlin wanted to keep the transaction confidential because eBay would impose a fee for carrying out the transaction. This is something that I guess a lot of us are familiar with, more so on a micro level, if you've ever used Facebook Marketplace. If you do the transaction through Facebook Marketplace, sometimes there's a fee and then you get dinged with taxes. And if you just communicate with somebody there and say, hey, let's do this cash or Venmo or something like that, most people are understanding and go, I get you. Sure, let's save all of ourselves a little bit of money here. But when you're dealing with what you claim was a $240,000 purchase, and now you're selling it for the bargain price of $80,000, it's a little more of an ask. The frames were covered in the pictures, and the back of the paintings, the Warhol Foundation verification stamps, were not visible when he gave over the paintings to the person who worked with Rivlin. Rivlin was in his car at the time and did not have the original eBay images with him to do the comparison. The individual who collected the paintings took a snapshot of them and forwarded them to Rivlin. However, as he believed the images to be similar to those in the advertisements, he gave his approval for the purchase. Go ahead, pick them up. I'm going to guess this is real. This guy seems pretty legit. All the conversations that he had, really, he felt good about. He felt good about making that transaction. After that, they handed Walsh a cashier's check for $80,000. Which he cashed almost immediately. When Rivlin removed the artwork's frames after receiving the following day, he discovered that the Warhol Foundation did not affix any authentication marks to the artwork. However, Rivlin was still certain that the paintings were genuine due to the fact that the Warhol Foundation numbers were listed at the bottom of the advertisement. But as soon as he got the piece into his hands, did a little research, he realized without delay that it was a forgery. He said this: I've bought over 1,000 Warhols, and this is the one and only acquisition that got by me. He was that good. Clever playbook and Oscar-worthy performance. It's a man who knows how to manipulate people, how to make people trust them. According to the evidence shown in court, he made 16 separate attempts to get in touch with Walsh by cell phone after the sale, but he was ignored each time. Similar to his South Korean friend, where he stole the Warhol frames initially, ghosting people. In the end, Rivlin was able to communicate with his wife, Anna, and Walsh reached him through email. A portion of the email reads as follows: The information you explained to my wife is very troubling. If the photos I sent you are clearly different than the shadows you have now, then that is a serious problem. However, regardless of the problems with the shadows, you have a right to a full refund according to our written agreement in section 9.3. I don't want you to suffer financially from this transaction, especially if the fault is on my side, he said. So he plays into this. He's like, oh, I got you, man. Oh, my goodness. I didn't know either, but I don't want you to suffer. We're going to make this right. How cunning and cruel is that? He's playing into this like, oh my gosh, I hear you. I don't want you to suffer one bit. Let me make this right. And then after someone says, let me make this right, they're gone. Over the course of the subsequent several weeks, Rivlin repeatedly requested money from him. And each time, surprise, Walsh made an excuse for why he could not pay him in full. In the end, Walsh repaid Rivlin $30,000. And that's it. He continued to offer various justifications as to why he was unable to return the remaining cash. That's what people like that do. They just keep stringing it out so you don't necessarily sue them or go after them in a legal manner because you're trying to make it right. We're going to get there. We're going to get there. But that's not all, folks. As if screwing over friends, acquaintances wasn't enough, let's go to family. Why not burn a few bridges there? After his relatives and friends accused him of destroying the will of his father and taking over his father's fortune, Walsh has also been at the center of that ongoing controversy there. The disagreement concerns of the estate that his father left behind. A friend of Brian Walsh's father, Thomas Walsh, mentioned to CBS Boston that Brian Walsh has a history of behaving in a deceptive manner. According to the acquaintance who requested that their conversation remain private, Walsh is not trustworthy. He did some things that were shameful and horrible to someone he really cared about, the person added, likely referring to what he did to his father prior to being cut out of the will. Walsh and his father had a falling out as a result of Brian stealing money. The alleged theft is included in the court filings as well. In an affidavit that was submitted to the court, Brian's cousin Andrew Walsh stated that Brian R. Walsh had absconded with almost $1 million from Dr. Thomas Walsh in the prior years. Andrew is Brian's brother. In addition to the court documents revealing that Walsh had a rough background and a protracted history of mental treatment. So we go to that because in almost any case like this, yes, there is mental problems at the core. Does not excuse any of the behavior. But if you want to get an idea why someone is acting as they are, take a look at that. It says, although he was born in a family with economic means, Brian Walsh's childhood can hardly be considered to be privileged. At once being used as a pawn by his parents in their acrimonious marital relationship, he was severely attacked when he was 6 years old by Doberman dogs brought home by his father to spite his mother, and being put on a pedestal as a replacement for a deceased uncle. Brian was emotionally abused from a very early age, reads a sentencing memorandum. According to the paper, because Walsh's mother led a solitary existence and his father passed away, he had no one else within or outside the family to turn to for support, because his mother really lived in seclusion for most of the life. So they were very isolated. He had the trauma, never got any help for it. The document stated that Brian was neglected, unloved, and emotionally scarred. As a result of this, it's stated by former psychiatrists who treated him, this might explain why he is the way he is today. So that's a little history for you on Brian Walsh. All that being said, let's bring in our guest today, Ann Bremmer. Ann is a trial attorney and one of the nation's most recognized legal analysts. Ann, thank you for joining us. The first thing I want to get to in the conversation here today about Brian Walsh is all of that, that criminal history. How, if, why will that come into play in this new trial of him murdering his wife?
With respect to the evidence in court, any crimes of dishonesty or false statement under Evidence Rule 609, it's A and B, can come into on cross-examination of a defendant on the stand, usually. Mm-hmm. And these would be crimes of dishonesty or false statement, especially to the art fraud. With respect to looking at charging him, those are, of course, things to look at, you know, in terms of financial motive he may have, you know, a life insurance of his wife, not having the income from her. He tested, I think he looked up whether he would inherit from her.
Yeah.
Things like that. So that would kind of be, they'd look at it more like, what is his financial motive? He had a motive, what was it? And it may have been in part for financial reasons.
That's what we're seeing a lot of. It was, I believe it's almost his fifth or sixth search in the query among how to get rid of bodies is asking about how long does it take to get an inheritance if the person is missing? Not dead, but missing. So I think the thought was in his mind, she'll just be missing. No one will ever necessarily find this. What does it tell you about his character with the fact that police went in and they found so much damning evidence right there in his house, knives in the basement? And this is someone who seems to think he is very smart, just judging by what we've seen and his attitudes and his past. Is this someone who is careless? Is this someone who is just so confident that it's to a fault? What does that tell you?
I think so. I mean, some people have described him as a sociopath, you know, out there in the media and social media. Mm-hmm. But he sure seems confident. He was even being, of course, monitored because of his other charge in terms of where he could go.
Yeah.
You know, $450 worth of cleaning supplies. You're wearing a mask and gloves to buy them. You know, paying with cash. The searches on his computer, many. The how to dismember a body. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the. Oh, and my wife. You know, she got on a rideshare to go to D.C. to get on a plane. Well, you know, wasn't her phone in the house or somewhere?
Yeah.
Not with her.
Yeah, it was all pinging at the house.
Right. So either you think he's the stupidest criminal out there, or maybe he's the smartest. I don't know, but this sure looks pretty damning to me. I think right now, in terms of all of his missteps, it's, you hear one after another, then you hear a new one, another misstep.
I know. It the list keeps going. What I'm wondering, because listening to the friend that had spent New Year's Eve with them, and then 6 short hours later, he's looking how to get rid of her body. And at New Year's, they seem to have nothing going on. There wasn't any sort of weirdness. There was no arguments. It was just a very calm, pleasant night. And then something happened in the middle of the night. What I'm wondering is, how premeditated was this? It looks like he was getting ready or considering getting divorced by his some of his search history. But then suddenly, New Year's Day, it goes to getting rid of a body. Do you feel that this might have been just something happened? He snapped, he did something to her, killed her, pushed her, did something, and then had to get rid of the body?
It could vary. The evidence suggests that, although in 2014, she'd posted kind of a cryptic description of a wound she had in her eye that looked like she could have been a victim of domestic violence. And given that, that may have escalated to where he killed her. But the fact that he's leaving so many clues and it appeared to happen suddenly could be that could have been he snapped, they had an argument, and he overreacted, etc. He could say it was an accident, you know, but then after the fact, I had to do all these things and search all these things because I was scared, you know, that she died in an accident, but I had to get rid of her body. I had to cover up, but that doesn't mean that I had premeditation in killing her.
It's almost like a manic, you know, oh my gosh, I did this. I have to go fix this very quick. And then which you end up having many missteps, which appears to what he did. But what gets me a lot is when you see him in court and you see his smirk, his smile, almost as if he's sitting there ordering a beer at an Applebee's. It's what he looks like. What is that? How do you, let me ask you this. How do you, in your work, when you would represent someone, a client, and maybe you've had one like that or something like that, when you have one, someone who has such defiance to reality or just the magnitude of the charges against them, whether they're guilty or not, how do you handle a client with that type of an attitude and that type of an appearance publicly?
You know, I've been up against people like that representing victims and civil and criminal. And so I've usually, for example, Josh Powell and Susan Cox Powell case was kind of, was like that. Remember, he was believed he killed his wife, and then he killed his 2 sons later in the case I had.
Sure.
That you use it against him. I don't know how you control somebody like that as a defense attorney, because he's not controlling himself. I mean, he did all of these things, and he still thinks he can go forward with impunity. So, and that somebody, any lawyer should win his case. That's how he looks in court. Like, of course I've got this, right?
Sure. There's such an air of confidence that it almost feels like he either knows he did it and he doesn't care one bit, or he's believing that, well, this is all just an error and I'm going to get out of here soon. And that's why I'm acting this way. I don't really care. Obviously, it enrages the public and enrages a family and anyone that cares about the victims of him. But it's just such a disturbing way to present oneself, almost to the point where I was evaluating earlier on the show where he is. Obviously, they're just labels, psychopath, sociopath, narcissist, and all that. Psychopath is kind of where I've been landing a lot of times with the lack of empathy, the lack of not even seeming to know right and wrong, or having no regard for it. Sociopaths sometimes can inch into that. Sometimes there can be a little bit of regret after the fact. This man doesn't seem to show any whatsoever after the fact.
I know. I know. And when you look, I mean, he just blithely went and sold fake Andy Warhol paintings. Yeah. You know, I like, of course he can do that. You know, he had this whole thing with his father's inheritance. Yeah. And now he's looking at his wife's inheritance, at least online, how to get it if she's missing. You know, he doesn't have any remorse from what I can tell, including when he appears in court, all eyes are on him and he just smirks and, you know, has kind of that blank look on his face. Like what?
With something like this and the future where if this goes to trial with this much damning evidence against him, and I would say from the outside as just a person over here talking about it every day, it seems like there's much more damning evidence in this case than the Koberger case, even with the search history, with the weapons being found in his house, the back of his car with the tarps. Where do you see this one going? Is this something where it's likely to be a plea out and not get the death penalty? Or would something like this that's so, so damning and so obviously guilt is going to be the reality here? Do you see it going to court? Do you, I know he's pleading not guilty right now, but do you think this will end up in trial?
It's hard to say because this is a no body case.
So far,
the Susan Cox Powell case that I mentioned was a no body case, and Josh Powell was never prosecuted. He killed himself and his children long after she disappeared, but they all believed he killed Susan, but there wasn't a body. And so that gave them pause, and they didn't charge that case at the time that Josh killed the children. There are no body cases. There's even a website out there called nobodycases.com, I think it's called. So I think I got in touch with that person back when I tried the Cox Powell civil case. And, you know, that they can be won. But look at this. Maybe the family wants to know where she is.
Yeah.
Maybe they want more answers. And he may try and plea bargain that and say, you know, I'll get a life sentence or life without parole, and I'll tell you where she is. That could be a possibility. I just don't know. But that's something that where you can't find the body, that the family sure wants her to rest in peace. They want to find her and put her to rest finally.
I was surprised to see him being charged with murder so quickly. Were you, or is that typical? Because there is no body. And we're only on January 19th, and this happened around the 1st. Was it just so evident to prosecutors and such that this is a murder by his search history and the evidence that they had that they knew it was a murder and there's probably not any chance of her turning up as to why they made those charges?
Well, you summed it up beautifully. That's exactly what they have. And when they read out the evidence in court, I mean, it was just chapter and verse.
Okay.
So they feel confident and they wanted to make sure they were holding him on murder. They had those other charges, remember, but they wanted him on the homicide.
Is having a body, how important is having a body in a murder case?
Well, it's very important, you know, because you don't want the jury, there's that old, you know, story where they don't have a body and then they say to the lawyer says to the jury, watch, so-and-so, the victim's going to walk in that back door. All the jurors look over, reasonable doubt, they could still be alive. So, you know, that fact lends itself to reasonable doubt. On the other hand, there's a lot of no body cases over the years that have been charged, and circumstantial evidence is as valid as direct evidence. She's not seeing her kids. You know, she would never leave her kids.
Sure.
She's making no transactions financially. They're going to have, we'll see what they have in terms of DNA and blood evidence, and also analyzing the other items, you know, potential murder weapons in the case, and then a search history. You put that all together, and a jury could find that he did it, even though no one could find her.
Obviously, he's not going to be getting the kids back, at least anytime soon.
No, I
know they're in Child Protective Service custody. Where do you see those kids ending up? Is this something where they could end up with family members, or are they going to be into the system, or where do you feel that will go?
I sure hope they end up with family members. What a horrible thing. They're very young, and it's just a tragedy that they're going through this. Hopefully you don't want them in the Child Protective Services custody for long, or even in the foster care system. And there's wonderful foster parents, but it's better if they're with their family. And again, with the Susan Cox Powell case, those children, I represented the grandparents, the parents of Susan, and they wanted to take those kids. And they had real difficulty, you know, getting those kids because the father was alive and not charged. But here the father's alive and he is charged.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, a family member would be so important. I also had a case out here years ago where a husband killed his wife and the kids went to family immediately. And it was a transition that was terribly difficult, but also a lot more seamless than going through the system.
Ann Bremner, trial attorney and one of the nation's top legal experts. Thank you so much for joining us today and discussing the case with us. That's going to wrap up the discussion and information for today that we have for you. If you like this program and want more breaking updates and discussions, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of those updates. You can even get a commercial-free experience through Apple Podcasts as well. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod for more thoughts on this case and others off the air. For all of us at True Crime Today, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us.